there are some people still coming in, but I think we haven't stopped. We actually are already a little bit late. So let's. I'm looking forward to this session on theology and law. We have three speakers: Peter Haberman, Margriet Williams, and Godfried Siskar. Is Godfried you? Oh, I was wondering who is Godfried. So good to see you. Our first speaker is Peter Haberman. Now, Peter is a minister in the United Presbyterian Church, and he is very interesting in the sense that he has qualifications in law and in theology. He has a master's in practical theology from Stellenbosch, and he has an LLB from Witwatersrand, and he's busy with his doctorate. So, Peter, we're looking forward to your paper, The Tower of Babel. Good. Let's welcome him.
Good afternoon. My topic of this paper is the Tower of Babel and the shaping of South Africa. I would like to read the text and from the New Revised Standard Version. Genesis 11:1 to 9. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. They migrated from the east. They came upon a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. They said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top to the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, otherwise we shall be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth." The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the mortals had built. The Lord said, "Look, they are one people, they have one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. Nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language there, so that they will not understand one another's speech." The Lord scattered them abroad from there, over the face of all the earth. They left off building the city. Therefore it was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. I've chosen this passage because the first 11 chapters of Genesis have been amongst the most influential texts on the theological and political history of our nation. This particular chapter exercised influence far beyond its length. There are a number of ways you can interpret this text, and the way in which we interpret it has profound implications. I shall outline the way in which this text was interpreted by the Dutch Reformed Church under the framework of a quintet, and how this interpretation was challenged by a member of our own denomination, the Presbyterian Church of Southern Africa, now the Uniting Presbyterian Church. And it was this challenge, amongst many others, which eventually led the Dutch Reformed Church to proclaim apartheid a heresy. It was the theological decision to interpret this passage one way that led directly to apartheid becoming a political ideology. It was correspondingly a challenge to this interpretation that led to the dismantling of apartheid. Long before apartheid was a political ideology, it was a theological hermeneutic that came under the experience of, at that stage, the all-white Dutch Reformed Church. As apartheid was grounded within a specific theological hermeneutic, it was necessary for the dismantling of apartheid to require a different hermeneutic. And then I want to sound two warnings that this text continues to sound for us in our new constitutional democracy. Firstly, then, the structure of the passage. Now, I'm not going to go into long discussion about the structure of the passage itself, except to say that Cotter points out that the linguistic repetitions in this passage, the text of the themes of inclusion, unity and scattering, decision-making, as well as repetition of the words for name and there, also have a unified purpose. And he says the inclusion shows what the story is about. Unity is transformed into disunity. The repetition functions in a similar way, to highlight the desire for unity and its frustration, that the two actors in the story, God and humanity, are working in opposite purposes, and that the name, the reputation they expect, is entirely different from the name they achieve. He proposes three ways in which to interpret the passage, but the one which I prefer makes verse 5 the central point, the turning point of the narrative. Verse 5, the Lord came down to see. Yahweh comes down to see. And Yahweh takes responsibility for the scattering of the people into different languages and cultures. Brueggemann writes that the structure of the narrative shows that the resolve of humanity is in conflict with the resolve of God. The action of Yahweh responds to and correlates deliberately with the actions of humanity. And I would suggest that it's this action of Yahweh that sets up the Abraham narrative that is to follow. It's out of the multitude of languages and cultures that Yahweh selects one person through whom to bring about blessing to all the scattered peoples of the earth and to reverse the curse that has been proclaimed at the time. Brueggemann says that traditional interpretations of this passage see it in either or terms. The disobedient unity of the people based on pride or the scattering done by God as punishment. Over against this, he says that we should see the passage as a unity built by God based on your loyalty to him. Yeah, that unity is expressed as a dispersion over the earth. Brueggemann argues that the passage is not simply about unity or scattering, but the kind of unity and the kind of scattering that happens. He suggests a dialectic of unity and scattering. A unity willed by God, as opposed to a unity that defies God, and a scattering that is likewise willed by God, as opposed to a scattering as God's punishment, which gives expression to the will of God. We must question Brueggemann here, firstly, whether these two are already in conflict with one another, but more profoundly, whether the different interpretations that Brueggemann suggests are value neutral, or whether there are some readings and interpretations that we should prefer over others. O'Connor points out that there are no interpretations that are value neutral, and in her article on this text, she refers to a number of different interpretations. Ellen von Walder's semiotic reading of the passage, Theodore Hibbert's interpretation which celebrates Babylon as the cradle of civilization, John T. Strong, who argues that the tower is a construction in which people put their own image. She points to the reception history approach of Anne Le Coq. She talks about the need to recognize post-colonial historical critical analysis of the text, and she talks about some of these. And her point is to say that no interpreter comes to a text neutrally. Each interpreter brings their own baggage with them. What about an apartheid reading of this passage? In the South African context, the Tower of Babel story has been enormously influential. Smith and Kluter, in their article written about the time of South Africa's the birth of our democracy, say that apartheid has been an attempt to organize public life after Babel. Apartheid theologian used Genesis 11 more than any other pericope from scripture to defend apartheid. Why? They saw the punishment at Babel as a blessing. The people were divided according to their different languages, which meant that they could no longer understand one another. They could no longer cooperate and live together. They were spread over all the world and lived in separation. For the people adopting the ideology of apartheid, this was wonderful, regarded as a blessing from God, and the way in which God fulfilled his work of creation. Later they say apartheid wanted to make South Africa a society after Babel. The scattering was seen as an act of God's grace. It was interpreted to mean that it was good that God had confused the people through their different languages. They could no longer understand one another, and as a result, could live and develop separated from one another. The critique of this reading that I want to point to is one by the Reverend D.S. Bax. It was done in two very important articles. Well, one was an article, came out of a booklet, that was written as a memorandum for a meeting of the World Alliance of Reformed Churches in March 1979. It was a response to the document put out by the Dutch Reformed Church at the time called Ras, Volk, and Volksverhoudingen en die Lucht van Schrift. A report published in English under the title Human Relations and the South African Scene in the Light of Scripture. Bax wrote a booklet which was later published. He also published a sermon on this passage. In his sermon, Bax talks about two different interpretations. He talks about the apartheid interpretation. Over against this, he suggests another interpretation. The first point he makes in his alternative concerns the general theme of the passage. The people travel, select the site, develop new technology in the production of bricks and mortar. This shows, he says, that the story, at least at one level, is about the dangers inherent in human self-importance that is based on cultural superiority or technological progress. The second point he makes is about the sin of the people on the plain. The root sin is that the people feel the need for security based on cultural superiority, and they use their technological progress to build a symbol of that unity and security. The third point for him is that unity based on cultural superiority, technological progress highlights the dangers inherent in human arrogance. Arrogance is based on human pride, hubris, and glories in achievement. The moral of the story is that every civilization throughout history that tries to claim a permanent place for itself through its own glory and achievements will eventually collapse. The higher the civilization attempts to climb, the greater its fall. Considering that he wrote this in 1983, at the height of the struggle against apartheid, his words ring with prophetic clarity. He says, "So we too in South Africa need to consider what will be the fate of all the pretensions that we and our leaders make about our political, social, and spiritual accomplishments." Well, this story of the Tower of Babel describes man as he is. Man today, therefore, we are still in the land of Shinar. We still build our pretentious towers out of our anxiety about our identity and our anxiety in the face of the threat of our finitude. That's his fourth point, is about God's evaluation of human hubris. He uses verse 5, several verses in the passage, to say that although humans think they've done such a great thing, God has to come down very close. It's so small, he has to come very close to see what's happening. Finally, he says it's God's action that confuses human language so that human beings are unable to understand one another, and human beings are reminded of their own limitations, their own mortality. All humanity's attempts to become godlike are dismal failures. The beginning of the end of the Tower of Babel story is the beginning of the Abram cycle in Genesis 12. And this becomes the means by which the curse of division will be overcome. In, through, by, because of Abram, all nations that have been cursed will now be blessed. What about the Tower of Babel narrative, metaphor, and our own constitutional democracy? Although we are now in a new era, the metaphor, the story, continues function as a warning to the builders of the tower that the reputation they expect may be entirely different from the reputation they achieve. Those who build the tower desire unity, they achieve disunity. This might be particularly so when the tower itself becomes a symbol of human self-importance based on cultural superiority or technological progress. The dangers are specifically evident where that self-importance, cultural superiority, and technical progress all comprise to build a symbol of unity and security based on human arrogance. A symbol that glories in achievement. In that case, the tower might come to function as a false symbol of unity and security that seeks to banish anxiety in the threat of our finitude. In our constitutional democracy, the Tower of Babel narrative continues as a cautionary tale, a caveat against the dangers inherent in cultural superiority, technological advancement, and human arrogance. And that warning may center on the Constitution itself. Beck says this in the booklet that he wrote. He warns of this. It's not the people's unity or their cultural or ethnic homogeneity that was artificial or contrary to God's will or command, but their attempt to use this unity to achieve a cultural and technological identity and greatness and fame of their own, and so by their own achievement to save themselves from the threat of finitude, dispersion and insignificance which they felt in the face of vastness and mystery of the world. Courted as a model of democratic values and underpinned by a strong human rights culture, the Constitution is a remarkable achievement, but I would contend that it's possible for the Constitution itself to become a contemporary Tower of Babel. The specific question is whether in our constitutional democracy, the Constitution, the interpretation and application of the Constitution by the Constitutional Court could achieve a reputation entirely different to that from which the framers of the Constitution hoped to achieve. Could the Constitution, which was meant to function as a means of uniting the nation around a national symbol, become a symbol that divides that which it was meant to unite? Could the Constitution become a symbol of human self-importance based on cultural superiority and technological progress, a symbol of unity and security based on human arrogance, a a symbol that glories in achievement, and consequently a false symbol of unity and security to banish anxiety in the face of the threat to 5G. Even asking this question is dangerous, because the Constitution is seen as such a remarkable document and a model for others. One cannot be critical of the founding values that are outlined in the preamble to the Constitution, nor the way in which jurisprudential announcements about the meaning of these paragraphs in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights have been fleshed out by the Constitutional Court. But I would sound two dangers. The first danger is that the Bill of Rights, with a strong emphasis on human rights, does not stress the corresponding responsibilities that should accompany the rights enshrined in it. The second danger is that the Constitution might find itself regarded as irrelevant by the people of South Africa, severely undermining the rule of law, if it fails to take seriously public opinion or cultural and religious rights, which you might designate as these established custom and mores of the people of South Africa. In his thought-provoking article, Foster provides a theological evaluation of the human rights culture underpinning the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. He says this: dignity talks about human dignity. He says, as soon as the human is alienated from its creator, God's likeness in the human is distorted, and he assumes a dignity that is not directed at God but towards himself. The consequence is that the human then tends to demand rights for himself in a selfish manner, without accepting the corresponding responsibilities that accompany rights. Second danger is that the Constitution becomes divorced from the social mores of South African society. Goodsell sounds this morning in her article. She says, while the South African Constitution and Bill of Rights can certainly be described as truly modern, the reality is the majority of South African individuals are not so modern in their political values. Many of the rights embraced in the Constitution and Bill of Rights do not reflect majoritarian sentiments. Instead, they are based on international human rights norms. She mentions three as examples. She says that while studies suggest the majority of South Africans oppose abortion on demand and same-sex marriages and support capital punishment, the Constitutional Court has upheld the constitutionality of abortion on demand, ordered the state to make provision for same-sex civil unions, and held capital punishment to be in conflict with the Constitution. She writes, whatever one's opinion on gay marriage, the court's strong stance in favour of is an instance of the court's commitment to Western human rights norms, regardless of local public opinion. If the court continues to forge a path so different from its people's traditions, without recognising or respecting those traditions, respect for constitutionalism and the rule of law may be undermined, the purposes of the Bill of Rights subverted, as has happened in so many of the young democracies in post-colonial Africa. If the Constitution itself fosters self-importance, emphasizes cultural superiority and technological process, if it creates a security based on cultural superiority, if it amplifies human arrogance, it runs the risk of becoming a symbol of unity that is not built on relationship and responsibility, but on entitlement and privilege. If that is what it becomes, the tower might stand,
unity and pluralism coexist in South Africa. Okay. Thank you.
Peter, if you can respond, unfortunately we have
time. The link between Burma and Pentecost is fairly well established. I think in the common lectionary, I haven't looked, but I think in the common lectionary most times, or most years, the Pentecost text with the Old Testament reference will be Genesis 11. So clearly, I think most of us would see the Pentecost as the ultimate reversal of the curse of Babel. I think the issue about the apartheid reading of the text was that in the apartheid theologians' minds, Babel, the curse of Babel was seen as blessing. And that's the inversion that happened. Most would read that as curse, but they saw it as blessing. And I think the text also has is strongly helpful for us to understand pluralism. I didn't push that too much in my paper, but there's an implication that there is a certain unity that is expressed through diversity and should be expressed through diversity. The Abraham narrative, this whole concept of I will bless you, all nations will be blessed through you, by you, because of you, is an indication of that, I think. Early indication of that.
Thank you very much, Peter. I think let's move on to the second presenter. It's not really necessary to announce her because I think we all know Margriet from the emails that we received. I'm sure you all received an email or two from her. Margriet de Villiers is a PhD candidate in the Department of Systematic Theology and Ecclesiology here at Stellenbosch. And she's working particularly on Hannah Arendt and more from a philosophical perspective. So, Margriet, welcome, and we look forward to your paper. But let's welcome her.
Thank you so much, Chair. As you've heard, I'm doing my PhD in systematic theology at the Faculty of Theology, but I'm focusing on somebody who is in actual fact a philosopher, a German-American social thinker and philosopher called Hannah Arendt. And she found herself as a stateless, and which would imply that in our modern political society, as rightless. So she found herself as a rightless person after fleeing from the Second World War Europe to America, where she was only granted permanent citizenship after 10 years. This experience, along with her work with wartime refugees, forced her to reflect on the changing modern political landscape that was taking place. She reinvestigates the difference between universal human rights present within humanity and the state law rights that are awarded to individual citizens. And she concludes that it is preferable to rather refer to all people's rights to have rights. So therefore, in my following paper entitled The Right to Have Rights, Engaging Theologically with Hannah Arendt in a Pluralistic Society, I would like to explore Arendt's explication of human rights by focusing firstly on her understanding of the changing political sphere of her time, but is still showing some extant characteristics in ours. Secondly, to investigate her concepts of what she hears about the terms universal human rights and state law rights. And then thirdly, look at her work and hope to find something of a new form, an alternative viewpoint, a new alternative philosophical, theological, or general view via her concept, The Right to Have Rights, on human fundamental human rights in modern pluralism societies. So firstly, a bit of a background. As a Jewess who was born and bred in Germany in 1906 in Arnulfing, the German-American political theorist and philosopher Hannah Arendt lived through and was profoundly influenced by both the First and Second World Wars, wars that shook the very foundation of world politics. With the start of her philosophical studies in 1924 at Marburg University, she meets and befriends the German existence philosopher Martin Heidegger, whose work and whose friendship and ideas would come to have a huge impact on her philosophical and her political formation. During Heidegger's years as a rector of Freiburg University, his support for the Nazi regime became more apparent. and this placed his friendships and his work under worldwide scrutiny, which in turn brought the Jewish friend Hannah Arendt under scrutiny as well. And it is at this time, at this point in her life, that Arendt is inducted into the world of Jewish Zionist politics, and she becomes involved in Zionist movements and discussions and activities. Therefore, when the Nazi regime starts to flourish in Berlin in 1933, Arendt's so-called various unpatriotic activities forces her to flee to Paris, and for the first time, she finds herself as a stateless person. From Paris, she would then help to transport Jews to the homeland of Palestine, but with the declaration of war between France and Germany in 1940, Arendt and her husband are forced to set sail to America, where they subsequently settle in New York. Here she continues her work and interests with special focus on the atrocities of the concentration and extermination camps in Germany, as well as other human rights violations of the war in Europe. It is only in 1951, 18 years after first leaving Germany, that Hannah Arendt receives her American citizenship. For the first time in 18 years, she belongs to a state, and is she able to make herself at home in a community? At home in a country where, as she states it, she has the freedom to be a state citizen without having to pay the price of assimilation. Living through such dark, albeit very interesting times, Hannah Arendt responds to the crisis of her times and the happenings of her times by evaluating and re-evaluating political theory. She comes to identify Nazism and Stalinism, which at that stage was the two disruptive political phenomena of the times, as totalitarianism, a terror-based socio-political system that makes use of indoctrination and coercion to rob persons of their innate humanness, which she specifies as individuality and the freedom for spontaneous thought and action within a community. Arendt found the examples of her friend Martin Heidegger and the example of Adolf Eichmann, who was an officer in charge of transporting the Jews to extermination camps in Europe. She was also the reporter for the New Yorker magazine in Jerusalem in 1961 when he was standing trial. And she finds the example of Adolf Eichmann and the example of Martin Heidegger to be prime examples of the influence of such a totalitarian regime. Looking at the war and its atrocities that people could never imagine, taking the indoctrination of people as well educated as Heidegger into account, and identifying the banal, unthinking coercion of key players like Eichmann, she comes to the conclusion that totalitarianism is a novel form of government, the likes of which had no historical precedent. Where the past and its traditions and thoughts could and should be used to generally help illuminate present situations, totalitarianism showed that such historical paradigms were no longer of use. Arendt then set out to deconstruct the essence of this regime and the effects its ideology had on the political theory of the day, as well as the people within its system, to help form new political paradigms with which to address the modern political arena. New paradigms regarding politics, the role of the state, and the enforcement of human rights had to be envisioned for the ever-changing present and future. Universal rights or civic rights, she asks, rather the right to own rights. Since the 18th century, with the occurrence of the French Revolution and the Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen, human rights have been espoused as naturally inalienable parts of humanity. The source of humanity was no longer necessarily attributed to God or an external godhead or a moral figure. It wasn't also attributed to any external law per se, but it was attributed to the human itself. Rights were therefore seen as universal and eternal, to be whatever humanity wants, and all persons would be protected and defended by them. Even before this period, Arendt writes in her Origin of Totalitarianism that what we must call a human right today would have been thought of as a general characteristic of the human condition, which no tyrant could take away. End quote. Famous last words. Laws would not be needed to enforce and protect these human rights, but would rather be based on them. And yet, these universal rights present in humanity, from humanity, were shown to be a bit more abstract in nature, not focusing on the individual as such, but rather on a general concept of humanity, the so-called people. It seemed that for an individual reinforcement of these rights, these specific people in question, had to belong to a group that would deem it important to enforce and protect this natural, inalienable right, if it were to come under threat. The nation state, according to Arendt, was born to be just such a group. Through the endowment of the legal and political status, the government provided their citizens with protection of their rights. For Arendt, this leads to a very problematic occurrence, namely the conflation of universal human rights and civic rights. Universal human rights, which are considered inalienable, as we have said, became controlled by the political system of the state through civic rights, and could only be guaranteed within that specific political community. The state thus becomes, to a certain extent, the protector and distributor of the nation's rights. If you were stateless, you were therefore rightless. Now, for the many who view the nation state and its modern democratic government, as we like to call it, as steadfast and unchangeable, that provides present and future stability, security, freedom to its people, that creates a community of equals, these would not question the state's involvement to such a degree with regards to human and civil rights. In fact, it would be seen as for the best. But Arendt contends that many extant characteristics of totalitarianism reside in such a political system, and that such thinking regarding rights is not demanding enough. Civil rights, although they do incorporate fundamental universal human rights, are not enough to secure the rightfulness of individuals, even within their own states. If we wish to bring about the deepening change with regards to the practice of human rights, perhaps it's good to reflect on what we think it means to be rightless. For Arendt, the key to this discussion lies in the rightful appearance of individuals through speech and action in a community of equals, all struggling together for a context-appreciative common good. What does that mean to her? It means a meaning for human life, this common good, for that context. And it is changeable as the context changes. As humans, she says, we receive much of our identity by expressing our uniqueness to others. Through this appearance to fellow humans, we receive the opportunity to express not only the what of myself, my gender, my race, my language, but the who of who I am. And we do so by using our capacity for speech to voice our opinions, our ideas of what we envision for our context appreciative common good. To be rightless, she says, is therefore to be deprived of a place in the world, whether it is a state or a community, where this speech and opinion can be voiced, where your contribution is of no significance. Our uniqueness and individuality, our humanness, goes by without appearance to others, and it is therefore as if we never existed. We therefore also have no capacity to act. Arendt sees action as that which goes on, and I quote, directly between men without the intermediary of things or matter. Action for art is therefore the pure appearance of human to human, an unadulterated moment of expression of opinion, of identity, of ideas. But if there is no forum for this action to take place, then, and there is no moment for speech, then we cannot identify ourselves, our insights, our opinions, our contexts, our experiences. We cannot bring them to one another. As a side note, Arden is prominent in saying that she still feels that our democratic system as we see it is not democratic enough, because we do not have this forum for people's opinions and people's speech, and that's often why laws and constitutions do not rhyme, for instance, with what people do in the public and private sphere. She says through this, not being able to express ourselves, not being able to be in our world, we lose touch with humanity, we lose touch with reality, and she says most importantly, we are deprived of something truly fundamental to our beings, being able to help build our own world. As history has shown, there is no guarantee that either abstract universal human rights or state-based civil rights can ensure each individual's fundamental right to appearance through speech and action. But what then can ensure this fundamental human right? Not what, but who, says Arendt. Humanity. Only we, not as a group, but as one human to another, can ensure our right to have rights. What does this mean in a pluralist society? Arendt uses the phrase the right to have rights to indicate the shift in focus of the source of human rights. She says it is not to be found in an abstract idea of humanity. It is even not to be found in looking to God or a moral entity that leads and guides us. It's also not found in state laws that focus on governance. She provides a third option. A context-based individual. This is what the right to have rights means. The source of human rights through right to have rights means she provides a context-based individual who acknowledges him or herself to be a person of right and enforces every other individual's rights to mutually equal rights. Not only is the context-based humanity the source of the human rights, but also the enforcer and protector thereof. Hannah Arendt makes it quite clear that our modern democratic understanding of human rights might be hindering our process to move away from a totalitarian-filled history to a more politically active community. A community of speech and action. A community of participation and responsibility. We have a responsibility to each other and ourselves to enable mutual sharing of opinions and actions, and in so doing to affect in each an enlarged mentality, which you get from Kant, of what it means to be human. Such a mentality can only take place within a pluralist society where a multitude of opinions and backgrounds help us to form our thinking and assist us in appreciating and understanding one another regardless of national affiliation, religious conviction, or political distinction. Our rights are therefore not based on structures, but on a decision of a guarantee to ourselves, to the right to have mutually equal rights. Seeing as any and all structures that we could employ to enforce human rights are man-made, human-made, and can be changed by human command, Arendt says this earnest guarantee is in effect the only thing that we can really offer each other that is worth. By giving such a guarantee, we admit to ourselves and to each other that we realize that we need one another to be able to be. Without another to whom we can appear and act through speech, Arendt says, I do not fully exist. Arendt touches upon something, and I'd like to end with this. She touches upon something that we as Africans, I think of as Ubuntu. And I'd like to quote the piece that Professor Dreyer has also quoted this morning. And I think Arendt would agree with the words of Desmond Tutu. A person of Ubuntu, or a person of who believes in the right to have rights, as Arendt quoted, is affirming of others based from a proper self-assurance that comes knowing that he or she belongs in a greater whole and is diminished when others are diminished. Perhaps in this way, Arendt can help us in thinking about the future of human rights in Africa.
Based for us in our country, we think of all the refugees and the xenophobia and so many people without rights. And they're not out there, they're here. So let's just maybe one question. I'm sure you must have questions.
I might just underline when we talk about rights. We be separated from responsibility in government problems. And basically, to sum it up, we must agree to disagree without being disagreeable and give people opportunity to express what they're thinking, what they're feeling, and what action they would like to do. But to submit that to one another. I just want to, I think the most important thing is that it's not structure, it's relationship. First with the Lord and with one another, but to really humbly walk before God and not forget Him in the discussion, and really submit it to Him and then to one another, but enjoy being at the freedom to express what I really think and not try to bluff you or make you feel happy about what I think.
Can I react to that shortly? If we think about the time in which Hannah Arendt wrote this, it was during the time of the Second World War, right after that she's a Jewess, and religion has been used, or was used in that time, this idea of God giving me human rights but only for my group, or only for my religious group. And that really went against the grain from her, because she says, then what you're trying to do is assimilate. You're not trying to go for a pluralistic society, you're trying to go for a society that will do and say whatever you like. And she believes, like Kant to a certain extent, that we do need God. If you believe in a God, she doesn't really care which one. But if that is the one that centers you in your relationship, and not in the structures, not expecting the law to provide a people with dignity or to affirm the dignity that they have, but if that God helps you then to be centered in your knowledge that you are a person with dignity and therefore you are responsible for the others, she says, then that is the best thing that could be for society.
I'd like to add another word. That's respect for the other person. And the Ten Commandments, really, if you look at it, it's the whole time, respect the other person. Don't be jealous of him. Don't take his wife. Don't steal from him.
Yeah.
With him. We tend to think that the right human rights means me. It's about God is encouraging us. It's the right of the other person.
Because you can't live without that other person. And therefore, if they have no rights, you have no rights.
Thank you very much for your presentation and also the other one. One of the things that seemed to come out from your paper and the question that I asked, just to link it up with the other, is how universal is Ubuntu? Because when trying to approach it from an African perspective, my experience is yet some. Yet, when you speak about Hannah Arendt's work, there's an element of all of this in there. And so I don't know if this is a question, but I was listening also to Peter's earlier point and his questions. about our constitution and how that can all go wrong and so on. And I wonder if we approach our constitution from, I don't know what to call it, Ubuntu philosophy, the Ubuntu thing.
Or the right to have rights.
The right to have rights. Where does those questions then go? Do we not have in South Africa at least a situation where our constitution is providing a certain amount of guidance to the right to have rights?
Yes. I think this with Ubuntu and the constitutionality, especially now focusing on Arendt because that's all I know, to have that is to not be structureless. I mean, we do need guidance, we do need people of knowledge to help us informing our thinking, not enforcing it, but helping us to say maybe we should move in this direction or move in this direction. So structures are needed, but perhaps what is important is that we realize that we have a unique society with a context that has different common good than perhaps other political system. And our constitution rights and our thinking of human rights, our politics needs to adapt to that. And that's where hopefully a different angle of saying, well, maybe if we step back and look at human rights and the constitution and the enforcement of law from a different perspective, we can see the change in nuance from state infrastructure to personal responsibility. Does that answer?
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Margrit. I'm sure you're going to produce a wonderful thesis in the end, if this is the quality of work. So thank you very much. And now our third speaker, I hope I pronounce it correctly, Reverend Godfrey Francisca. And he is from Zambia, but he's also a student here in South Africa at the University of Pretoria. So at least there's some connection between me and Reverend Francisca, because I live in Pretoria. So very welcome, and he is going to speak on protection of Africa, traditional law, and African traditional religion. Very welcome. Let's give him a round of applause.
Thank you, the chairperson. I'm delighted to stand here and to be given this opportunity that I can I can present the substance of my paper. When the two speakers were giving their presentation, I sat there and asked a question that which model or approach can I use to give my presentation. So the immediate thought which came to my mind that I'll use a song model from African tradition religion then to entertain all of us. That was just a joke. Allow me to go straight to the substance of my presentation. The title of my presentation is Protection of African Tradition Law and African Tradition Religion. And I'll speak to the paper. I won't literally read. I'll use what I describe a multidimensional approach to discuss this, which is based on a legal and theological reasoning. Having said that, allow me to use the definition of Ndulo 2000, is a leading legal scholar from Zambia, but is in overseas and has been doing a lot of writing. He defines African traditional law as a legal thinking from the past, which the forefathers used to believe in. I agree with his definition, but I'll come back to that later. But let me give briefly a bit of background to my paper. First and foremost, I'll talk about African traditional law, which is more or less customary law. Others have referred to it. Others have referred to it as a native law. I'll talk about that, then I'll end with African tradition religion. In other quarters, I've referred to this as African religion. Others have referred to it African religions. I'll deal with this subject in that same direction. As from the introduction by the chair, I'm from Zambia, so some of the things which I'll be discussing, they'll be parallel in other African countries as we go on in our discussion. But it's very important for you to take note, even as I discuss African tradition law, that within the Zambian context, African tradition law or customary law is administered under the local court. It's administered under the local court and is applied in there. The legislature of the customary law is under the local court. As I will give just a brief background of the Zambian legal system, there is a local court which is more or less native court, then there is a subordinate, high court, and magistrate. But at the magistrate or subordinate court, this law is not applied. Even at the Supreme Court, it's not applied. If it's applied due to some appeal cases, the judge or the magistrate need to ask an assessor, who is a person who is so familiar with the customary law, to sit with him to come to the justifiable conclusion or the judgment of the case. That's briefly about the background of the customary law and how it is administered in Zambia. It is very important at this stage for all of us, as a matter of fact, to take note of this, that there is no statutory definition of the term African customary law. And judges in Zambia have not attempted to define it or explain it. I think that is very important to take note of that. Another important factor to also take note is that when defining customary law, even Monandulo in his book 2000, he underlines the key word common knowledge. So people determine what is the customary law because there are no statutory or there is no statutory instrument will define what customary law or African traditional law is. And that's the first challenge which I pick. My main argument in all this as I deal with African traditional law is how to identify customary law that are in conflict with constitutional rights provided in the constitution of Zambia. I think that's where my argument is, to try to identify in the process of protecting the African customary law, which is applied at the local court level. But the big question is how to identify those customary laws which are in conflict with the constitution, because the constitution gives the framework that this can be administered in the context of Zambia. And another important question which I'm raising alongside this same argument, to what extent can we protect the customary law or African tradition law in its current form, taking into consideration the Zambian situation. My response to that, or my answer to that question, my position is to reform the customary law in its current state. I think that's the answer, or that's my position. Why considering to reform the customary law? The first, we need to take into consideration certain factors in the process to reform it or to adjust it. I want to read what I've put in my text. First, the study of sources of official Zambian law. Secondly, to compare official customary law concepts, general law concepts, and traditional law concepts. And the third point, based on the theory that customary law was more value-oriented than rule-oriented. More emphasis should be placed on the values or principles behind customary law and use of these values to reevaluate some of the customary law which are presently in use in Zambia. That's my conclusion as I discuss this first part of my paper on African tradition and law, how it can be protected. If that can be achieved, then it will be able to promote what is even part of the theme, the common good to all people, because those elements in the customary law which are in conflict with the constitution, then the people are not affected, those who are affected by some of the elements in the customary law. And even the issues of human rights, then they are covered if that can be achieved. Allow me also to say something, that's my conclusion, but in the paper I have defined what African traditional law is, the sources of traditional law, and even some of the cases which have taken place in Zambia courts, from the local court to an appellate court, even up to the Supreme Court, and where the judges have called an assessor who is so familiar with the customary law. I've discussed that in detail in the main text of the report. I don't want to go much that direction because of time. But allow me also to say something very important. I am very much aware of some of the cases in Zambia where, through the application of African tradition law, they have stepped on human rights, and which are stepping on human rights. Just maybe to point one example, in a situation where a lady who is not married has been pregnanted by a man, the parents can sue in the local court, sue the man who pregnanted the lady for two things or one thing. They can sue for violation of virginity or causing pregnancy. And the lady is engaged in that case as co-defendant. The lady who has been abused cannot sue, but the parents or the guardian can sue. Already that's a problematic thing which can be identified, and to see how best this can be worked out, because it's tapping on the issues of human rights. Another important aspect which I want to raise before I go to African tradition, religion, is the problem I have that customary law is treated as a foreign law in Africa, or in particular Zambia. Yeah, I think that's a big problem, because the justice system, if you look at the High Court Act, you see the Subordinate Act, they provide that the magistrate or the judge can engage the assessor to come in. It is assumed that they are not knowledgeable in customary law or African law, but they live in Africa. That's a problem which I sit with. And the second problem which I sit with is that the customary law is treated as a foreign law. It can be applied at other penalty courts. I think that's the challenge which I'm wrestling with. And to point even one example, whereas judges are presumed to know the common law of England and the principles of equity, raises an important question as to what is the actual value of customary law. I think that's a big challenge. Okay, on the other hand, let me say something about African tradition, religion. The big problem, I don't want to repeat what others have been saying, but I've been hearing so much about African religion, about Umuntu, etc., etc. But the big challenge which is there about African tradition, religion, which I sit with in the process of trying to protect the African tradition religion, it's the issue of recognition. I think that's the big problem, the issue of recognition. I think in my footnotes I've quoted quite a number of scholars, Mageza, Mbiti, etc., etc., who talk about the same issue. So even them, they're able to identify the same problem of recognition of African tradition religion. And even in terms of the publication, much of the publication has not been done by African writers or scholars. And that is also quite problematic. And another important point, even in the inter-religious dialogue, the African tradition religion is not put on the same footage with other religion like Islam, Christianity, etc., etc. That's the challenge. And if that is the case, then the problem of protecting African tradition religion, it's not going to be protected. And another problem I also identify, African tradition religion has been viewed from Christian norms, oftentimes from Christian norms, from Islamic norms, but not purely from indigenous African perspective. And all this makes the whole subject to be more problematic. I've talked quite a number of issues, other things, I'll skip them. I've talked about the study of African tradition religion approaches which are done. I've also talked about African culture and African tradition religion. And let me say this, which is very important, I take note of, that religion is part of culture. I've explained what this is all about. I've talked about African culture and African tradition religion. I've also talked about the hermeneutics of African tradition religion. Here I've quoted Mbiti and others. It is very much practical subject or talk. I am a minister in the United Presbyterian Church. But the experience which I've had is that when there is a funeral, my members go to African tradition religion. When they're in crisis, they want to find the answer, they go to a tradition doctor. And I'm able to agree with Mbiti that to some extent, that wherever a black African is, he carries with him his African tradition religion. Yeah, and I want also to state this, which also Mageza points out, that has become very common trend in Africa, that the church is growing very fast, especially those who have identified the African tradition elements and have incorporated them in their worship service. those churches are growing and people find it so appealing because of the inheritance which is there. Last but not the least, I've talked about the future of African traditional religion, that this should be embedded in the curriculum of theology. Magyaza refers to it as we, after the post-independent Africa, there is a need for going to the issue of rethinking or the issue of reconstruction of African tradition and religion. Last but not the least, I want to say the two, African tradition law and African tradition religion, they are inseparable. In other words, I say law should give a framework to religion. These two, they're compatible. It's more or less like the canon law and theology. They're working hand in hand. And so when you talk about African tradition religion and African law, they are incompatible. There is a thin line. In fact, maybe you may not even separate the two. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Godfrey. I think you've raised so many issues, and we look forward to read your full paper because I think it's so rich and so many things that you can learn from it. I just noticed also the importance of the power relations, who has the power to define, and so on. But I look forward to your paper. Let's quickly, sorry that we are a little bit late, but if there's an important question that you want to ask, yes.
I've never been to Zambia, but I've been studying Zambia. I did an article for the Journal of Law and Religion that was published in February, comparing religion and constitutionalism in Kenya, Tanzania, and Zambia. And one of the things I was looking at in the history of Zambian constitutional reform, and there have been many commissions apparently of reforming the constitution, was at times there were proposals to expand recognition of customary law. And the thing that I've been looking at in these religion and constitutional reform questions is there a greater religious pluralism developing? Because I know in Zambia, the Christian Nation Declaration and the preamble to the Constitution has still been constitutional. I mean, it's still been controversial. It keeps being accepted. So what I wondered was whether greater respect for customary law might also lead to greater religious pluralism. Is there any connection between those?
Thank you very much. I think that's a very brilliant observation and question which you have raised. To respond to that, to some extent, if we go the same direction, then it may promote that indirectly, or maybe behind the curtain, there's a lot of practicing of African tradition, religion, African customary law behind the cut dedicated. Thank you.
Thank you, Godfrey. I just want to end by saying again, thank you very much, Peter. And Godfrey, I see Margriet has left, but it was really well prepared papers. Thank you very much for the time and effort you put into me, and also for everyone's presence here. Thank you for coming and being here.